live streamed, as you all know, around the country, but it's also being simultaneously interpreted in Spanish through a live stream to the rest of the country. And so it's really important that we keep the noise and the rest of the crowd pretty low, because otherwise the interpreter's microphone will pick up you speaking rather than the interpreter speaking. So if you can please keep your no side conversations, please. And for you all, just keep in mind that there's an interpretation happening simultaneously, so don't talk too fast. Thank you.
Okay, great.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So I just wanted to welcome everyone here to this amazing space at the Festival Center. This is a Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival.
Yeah.
Truthful Tuesday, the first of a series of six. The Festival Center has been gracious enough to host us here in Washington, D.C., in the community. Faith and social justice community here in the city. And so we thank them for the space, and we're so excited that people here are from across the city and that folks are gathering nationwide in different learning circles and in their own homes and to think about more about how we got to the place that we're at and what we're going to do to really build a movement to change these conditions. So, without further ado, I want to bring up our theomusicologist of the evening, who's going to open us up with some movement culture arts. So Nina Marie Fernando, if you would come join us. Thank you so much for being here, and thanks, everyone.
I don't know if you want a little bit.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here tonight. So you probably know these songs by now. We're going to start with Somebody's Hurting My Children, all right? And we're all together going to sing, and it's gone on far too long. Can you say far too long with me?
Far too long.
Yes, it's gone on far too long. And then together at the end, we're going to sing, We Won't Be Silent Anymore. Can I hear that?
We won't be silent anymore.
All right. And if you're welcome to snap along if you like. Somebody's hurting my children, and it's gone on
far too long.
Yes, it's gone on
far too long.
Yes, it's gone on
far too long.
Somebody's hurting my children, and it's gone on
far too long.
And we won't be silent anymore.
Thank you.
Somebody's hurting my sister, and it's gone on
far too long.
Yes, it's gone on
far too long.
Yes, it's gone on
far too long.
Somebody's hurting my sister, and it's gone on
far too long.
And we won't be silent anymore. Somebody wants to build a wall, and it's gone on
far too long.
Yes, it's gone on
far too long.
Yes, it's gone on
far too long.
Somebody wants to build a wall, and it's gone on
far too long.
And we won't be silent anymore.
One more time.
Somebody's hurting my children, and it's gone on
far too long.
Yes, it's gone on
far too long.
Yes, it's gone on
far too long.
Somebody's hurting our children, and it's gone on
far too long.
And we won't be silent anymore again. And we won't be silent. Amen.
Amen.
Awesome. Well, that was great. Welcome. It's really good to have folks here in the room and joining us online. My name is Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris. I'm one of the national co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign, A National Call for Moral Revival. And we are broadcasting from Washington, D.C., where yesterday we launched 40 days of moral, nonviolent direct action.
Yeah.
That's right. And it was a powerful day. In more than 30 states across the country and in Washington, D.C., there were hundreds or thousands of people engaged in organizing and actions, taking to the streets, telling this country that we're headed in the wrong direction, that poverty and racism and ecological devastation and this war economy that devalues life have been going on for far too long. They've been hurting our people for far too long. And we won't be silent anymore, and we'll begin to organize to build a state-based, deep-rooted moral movement to change the direction that things are going in. And so it was a powerful day, and it follows a whole pattern that we're doing over the course of these 40 days, where on Sunday evenings we have mass meetings that are also nationally broadcast and live-streamed across the country and world. On Mondays in states across the country, in their state capitals and here in our nation's capital, we engage in organizing and direct action and civil disobedience, calling attention to the problems that are happening in our society. And then we gather on Tuesdays to reflect on the reason why those actions are taking place and what it's going to take for us to dig deep into our communities and actually build a social movement that will have the roots and the leaves to flourish into something beautiful and powerful that will change the direction that we're going in. On Thursdays, we also gather, and here in D.C. and people across the country are able to be a part of our Justice Arts Movement evenings, where we have theomusicology and movement cultural arts, folks from different genres and traditions of cultural expression have a chance to share and offer offerings to this campaign. And so people should come if you're here in D.C., if you're in one of the states across the country or somewhere else across this globe, please join us for those as well, as they'll be happening. We are the Poor People's Campaign, A National Call for Moral Revival. And we are engaging in launching these 40 days so as to be able to build a larger movement that can take on systemic racism, that can take on systemic poverty, that can take on ecological devastation, the war economy and militarism, and a distorted moral narrative that is deeply immoral and heretical in its roots. A narrative that blames poor people for the problems that we're having, a narrative that pits us against each other, a narrative that claims that we have not enough and scarcity when we're really living in a world of abundance. And this Poor People's Campaign is the beginning of something that is very big, and it is made up of amazing leaders all over this country and all over this city here in D.C. who are standing up and saying that it is time for change. I wanted to kind of open us up this evening. The way that the campaign is organized is that we're looking at these different issues, but in a very intersectional way, because we realize that systemic racism and systemic poverty are interconnected, that you can't actually end poverty without understanding the roots of racism, of genocide, of violence, that you can't understand systemic racism without connecting it to ecological devastation and to communities that are being marginalized, polluted, poisoned, and that the war economy is is very connected to the problems of poverty. When we live in a country that spends 53 cents of every discretionary dollar on the military, but only 15 cents on programs that uplift the poor, programs like health care, programs like education, that we have our priorities completely wrong, and that we can never actually end poverty until we restructure society in a way that puts people's lives first. So as we are organizing around these intersectional evils, we have come up with a series of themes that each week focuses on. Because we think that what we need to do to be able to build a moral movement from the ground up is first to make this country stop in its tracks, weep about the misery that is happening to so many people, commit to understand that reality a little bit more, and then organize in our community so we can actually come up with solutions. And so the first week, which is this week, is focused on women, children, and people with disabilities in poverty. And the theme, as we sang this just a minute ago, is somebody's hurting our people, and it's gone on far too long, and we won't be silent anymore. And so we want to look this evening in particular at how this manifestation of women and children and people with disabilities in poverty is so central to this campaign, how it's so central to the kind of oppression that people are feeling across this country, and what it means for us to set up a series of demands and an organizing drive that will change all of that. So what I wanted to do is start this evening with a quote from Scripture, and it's one that has informed this campaign quite a bit. We are a multi-faith, multi-racial, multi-gender, multi-issue, multi-everything campaign. And we have people of faith and people not of faith that are a part of this campaign. And yet we have a grounding in both the Constitution and in the sacred texts and traditions of the world's religions, as well as in the arc of the universe that bends towards justice. And so this evening I wanted to read this quote first from Isaiah 10, and then have us think a little bit about what it means in terms of why we're building this campaign. So, "Doom to you who legislate evil, who make laws that make victims, laws that make misery for the poor, that rob my destitute people of dignity, exploiting defenseless widows, taking advantage of homeless children." Laws that make victims, laws that make misery for the poor, that rob my destitute people of dignity, exploiting defenseless widows, taking advantage of homeless children. This was written a very long time ago, thousands and thousands of years ago. But its message still rings true today. When the average age of a homeless person in the United States is 9 years old, when 75% of people who are poor are women and children, when there are 4 million households who turn on the water and their kids are being poisoned by lead, when you can live in Flint, Michigan, and the governor could have made a decision that those families could get poisoned. "Doom to you who legislate evil, who make laws that make victims." This is the grounding, one of many groundings, that this campaign arises out of. Families living with poisoned water in Flint, homeless encampments in California and Oregon and Washington State that are being attacked by the authorities, throwing out people's stuff, taking kids away from their families. Families who are impacted in the Gulf Coast, now more than 10 years after Katrina, 5 years after the BP oil spill, who have no ability to make a living or livelihood because there's poison. The families on the U.S.-Mexico border who are calling for hugs, not walls, who enter into the Rio Grande River for 3 minutes with a family member that they haven't seen in 16 years. For the families in Lowndes County, Alabama, where there's raw sewage in the yards, where poor kids, both white and black, are developing parasites like hookworm, while the authorities have made sure that sanitation services are there for the businesses in the community. For the towns and cities across this country, where people are literally dying because they do not have health care. If anyone was a part of the action in Washington, D.C. yesterday, we heard of families whose children have died because they do not have health care. Thousands of kids and moms die every year because they don't have health care, because states refuse to expand Medicaid, because the health care options that do exist are so limited that people still can't get the health care they need. And then the low-wage workers that are organizing across the country, including in cities where there are now preemption laws that deny that city from being able to raise its minimum wage to a living wage. Doom to you who legislate evil, who make laws that make victims, laws that make misery for the poor, that rob my destitute people of dignity, exploiting defenseless widows, taking advantage of homeless children. This is so true today. So true today. And so what do we do in the face of this? We've gathered this evening because we have some powerful voices who have been educating and organizing and sharing culture in the community, and who have come forward to say that we need a poor people's campaign. We need a national revival in this country, and that we need to start somewhere, and that somewhere is being a part of a season of nonviolent organizing, direct action, and civil disobedience. The purpose of the Poor People's Campaign is threefold. It's to shift the narrative. It's to get our country talking about the issues that affect us and coming up with grassroots, real solutions coming from communities that could end poverty, that could take away systemic racism, that could change ecological devastation into beauty and harmony on the earth, and that could transform a war economy into a peace economy. The second focus of the campaign is to build the power of people from below. In states across the country, folks have organized in new ways already.
And then the third stage is for us to build a movement. And that means voter registration and mobilization. That means the set of demands that we've come up with. And I urge folks to go to poorpeoplescampaign.org for the demands that are a part of the campaign and to check out the Souls of Poor Folk audit that we did in collaboration with the Institute for Policy Studies, with some help from the Urban Institute, a team of amazing economists and sociologists, impacted folks, and policymakers. So at this point, I want to turn the program over, but I have an announcement, it looks like, first. Just want folks to know that we're gathered here in this room, and it's a powerful room of people. And we're gathered in this room at the same time as people across the country are joining our live stream. There are folks watching watch parties in North Carolina. Across the state of New York, we know of at least 5 cities. There are folks in Mississippi, Texas, Arizona, Vermont, Michigan, Washington, Oregon, West Virginia, Oklahoma, California, Arkansas, Ohio, Florida, and many more. And some of the folks that are tuning in are the folks that were engaged in the direct action yesterday. Some folks didn't get out till this morning, and they're tuning in this evening because we know that building a movement is more than mobilizing bodies. It's about moving minds. It's about moving hearts. It's about changing our very understanding of how we got to where we are and how we're going to come together to change it and to make it better. We have a belief in this movement, which is that we can't be loud and wrong. We were very loud yesterday. In Tennessee, they took over 2 highways. In New York, they shut down the whole Capitol area and closed every door to that state capitol. Nobody came in or out. Here in D.C., for anyone that was with us, we wailed on First Street in front of the Capitol. We wailed a mother's wail of losing her children because of poverty, because of the lack of health care. So we were loud. Our voices went high. But we know that if we're really going to be able to change this society, we can't just be loud. We have to be informed. We have to know how we got here, and we have to have a vision for how we're going to change things. And so when we were loud yesterday, we were loud talking about the demands of this campaign. We were loud saying, no mom should have to bury their child. We need and demand single-payer universal health care. Yep. When we were loud yesterday, we said, no mom should not be able to afford what she needs to afford to provide for her kids because her job pays so little, that we demand 15 in a union and living wages for all. When we were loud yesterday, we heard about how fracking, how copper mining, how other acts of destruction of the earth and extreme extraction are wreaking havoc, especially on Native American land, and how the earth, how water is life. And so when we were loud and we learned about that, we said, we demand to change our dependence on fossil fuels. We demand to build a true green economy that doesn't exploit Mother Earth. So these demands are coming out of struggles, and they're informed by deep research, by deep understanding. And that is connected to the kind of learning that we're doing this evening. So I'm going to turn it over to the moderator for our panel this evening. I want to make one announcement, which was that various folks are coming forward to be a part of these educational Truthful Tuesdays, and someone that was supposed to be with us this evening was Marion Wright Edelman, but she was unable to attend because of being under the weather. So people should keep her in your hearts and minds and lift her up, and know that we appreciate, you know, the role that she played back in 67 and 68 with coming up with the Poor People's Campaign with John F. Kennedy and Dr. King and many, many leaders, and that we appreciate the work that folks like her are doing still today. We have a great program for people this evening, and so I'm going to turn it over to Ross.
Good evening. I'm Roz Pellis. I'm one of the co-managers of the Poor People's Campaign. I'm also the vice president of Repairs of the Breach, one of the sponsoring organizations of this campaign. Tonight is special, and it'll be special every single Tuesday, because it's our attempt here to crystallize the themes of each week, to have some discussion about the themes that are being lifted up, and to go deep into them. And tonight is the first of those, and it surely is going to be wonderful because we've got some great panelists tonight. So I'll introduce these amazing women, and then we can get started. First, I'd like to introduce Mona Haidar. Mona is a mother of two boys, an artist, an activist, whose single, The Hijabi, was named one of the top protest songs of 2017 and one of the top feminist anthems in history. She has a master's in Christian ethics from Union Theological Seminary. Dr. Colleen Russell McCoy is with the Cairo Center for Religious Rights and Social Justice. She's done extensive research and has written about the theology of the Poor People's Campaign of 1968. She's contributed in the political education process of the Poor People's Campaign, the National Call for a Moral Revival. Colleen. And our final panelist is Reverend Claudia De La Cruz from South Bronx, New York. She is a mother, an organizer, and an educator. She's a member of the Popular Education Project, a national collective committed to working with grassroots organizations in the development of political education processes. Claudia has done work organizing with immigrants and young women in New York for over 20 years.
I love
you. You do. So what we have tonight, brothers and sisters, are three panelists, all women, who will speak to our theme tonight based on their work, based on their beliefs, and based on their best understanding of the world. And I can't wait to talk to all of you. But first, I think I'd love to hear just briefly what your work is, so we understand kind of what it is you've been doing for the past years. I'll start here, or we can start anywhere, but I'd like to start.
This is a trap.
It is a trap.
So, as Ross mentioned, my name is Claudia De La Cruz, and I've been doing work in New York City primarily through organizing and doing popular education or political education through popular methods. With youth, immigrants, and also with cultural workers in the South Bronx through the Rebel Diaz Arts Collective. And I am a member of the Popular Education Project, which is committed to developing political education and deepening the analysis and our understanding of what the systems are that are oppressing us and how they are interlocking and intersecting, not only in the United States, but also internationally, and kind of breaking the isolation that we often face and thinking that we are the only ones that are facing struggles and not necessarily looking across the seas and seeing what our government does in our name and that we have no awareness of. And so that's the popular education project and that's part of the work that I've been doing for 20 years now. So, yeah.
Hey y'all, I'm Mona. I grew up in Flint, Michigan, and so obviously the Flint water crisis is really close to my heart. We were actually living in Flint at the time, and we're part of the movement to sort of get people aware of what was going on at the time. My husband and I are both educators. We work with especially young people to increase their awareness that alternatives are possible and available to them. Alternative lifestyles, that we don't have to continue on in these models of consumption, these models of corruption, these models of oppression, that there are alternatives to these systems. And they look like love, they look like joy, they look like liberation, and they feel so much better than what we have going on right now. And one of the ways we do that work, my husband is getting his name is Sebastian Robbins, he is getting his certification in urban agriculture and food justice. And I do work in the intersections of arts and activism. So teaching young people that their voice means something, that it's important. And it's important for them to speak their truth to the world, because the world needs them and their truth in what we call the love economy. And that they are necessary in that economy. So yeah, with them, I see our more beautiful world growing from the earth up.
So I'm Colleen. I live in Brooklyn with my family, two children, and my husband John. I'm actually from Georgia, and grew up was introduced to the ideas of service and care for other and love for neighbor through the church. And it was really there that I got this idea that the Bible told us that that we were supposed to be thinking about each other. And that evolved in lots of different ways, not just in the way that I was originally introduced to it, which was service, but then became more of an interest in community organizing and student organizing and tenant organizing. But it was always in many ways for me part of my faith and part of my belief in really trying to think about how it is that, you know, even people that are not coming from a faith tradition are coming from a place of conviction about the dignity of others and the value of the world, the earth and the beings within it. And so I took some of these questions with me into the community organizing world, and then brought questions from the community organizing world and into the world of seminary, and really my work has continued to be in both of those places at the same time, with people of faith and with people who are organizing and you know, on the ground and wanting to think about how do our convictions shape what we think is possible and shape how we treat each other and how we think that that actually really something really revolutionary and big is necessary in order to really fulfill our rights and our dignity.
So, Colleen, I want to start with you. Colleen is probably one of the best experts in the country right now on the Poor People's Campaign. You've done a lot of study and you've written, quoted to, and look back at your work as we've crafted this campaign. And I really want to start with you to tell us a little bit about why this campaign is so important in this period, in this political time, just to give us a little background.
Well, I should say that the idea of studying and looking at the original Poor People's Campaign was not my own. That when I came into this work, there were generations of activists and community leaders who had been talking about this moment, and a lineage of people who had been involved in 1968 and then had continued to do this work. And many of them are still with us today and are part of the campaign today. And so I came into the into a network of community leaders and scholars who were doing grassroots organizing and then looking at history and saying, what are the lessons of history that are going to make possible us, both learning from our successes in the past and learning from our failures in the past? And one of the moments that we looked at and people kept referring to was the Poor People's Campaign. And really it was a moment when people came together across lines of difference and people claimed this word poor and said that this is not something to be ashamed of, this is something that is being... that there's a position that we are forced into, and it's a position that that we are going to refuse to be silent about, and also not be shamed out of coming together under this banner of a Poor People's Campaign. And it was really significant at this moment that this was 1968. The Vietnam War was at its height. There was both the highest deployment and the highest number of casualties in 1968. It was an election year. It was a year when segregationist Wallace carried 13% of the vote nationally. And so there was a very strong reactionary right in that year. They were coming out of the huge victories of the civil rights period, and people had been mobilized and had come together, and they had won these successes. And yet life was still a life of poverty for millions of Americans. It was a period of an expanding economy, and yet people were still poor. We had won civil rights acts, and people were still poor. And so King, Martin Luther King Jr., and others were looking around and saying, we have been a reform movement, and we must be a revolutionary movement. And we must start to tie together the anti-war movement, the young black movement that's really rising up in the country, but then we also have to look and not be isolated in racial and ethnic groups and realize that actually there are a lot of us, and that we're kept divided from each other by racial divisions, geographic divisions. And so King sought out not just individual poor people, but people that were poor people who were organizing in their communities, and brought them together. And it was right in the middle of this that he was shot. He was killed in the midst of really bringing together a new constellation of the leadership of the poor. And then it was the Poor People's Campaign that came after that. But this idea for what was possible and necessary at that time is one that people have really continued to talk about and there have been people talking about it ever since then. And this is the moment that we're lifting this up and seeing both commonalities and differences, and doing some things that are the same and some things that are really different. But I think that it's an idea and a vision that really still continues to speak to today.
Mona, how's this relevant to your work? How's this relevant to your work, Mona?
So I'm a Muslim who studies Christian ethics, and yeah, it's funny, I know. It's important work, though, to understand the foundations of colonization, of a doctrine of dominion, where the earth is subject to human use, human exploitation. Where humanity has the right to dominate any and everything we see fit. And specifically within the framework of white supremacy, that is especially violent and lethal, and especially toxic to the entire world. And so dismantling those systems for me as a Muslim, as a mother of two young boys who are white passing, is really important, because for them, as little white passing children who are half Syrian, it's important that they grow up in a system that they don't believe that they are better than anyone. That they don't hold the false belief that they have the right to do what they want with the earth. That they have the right to take what they want, right? And have whatever they want, right? That it's about something much larger, much bigger, called true spirituality. Not a pseudo-spirituality, but something true and real. Not that cheap grace that many theologians have written about, right? But something that is real and comes from a wellspring of courage, of bravery, something that we can really sink our teeth into, something of substance, right? And that work is difficult. And so I don't actually claim to be doing that work. Because to be doing that work like Dr. King did, like Malcolm did, it puts you in the line of fire. They will kill you for that work, right? And so I don't proclaim to be doing that work, because for me that is a high station, right? Those people have done and continue to do incredible work, and I strive for that certainly. But the work that I do is honor the youth who hold those values, and to tell them that we need you. Right, it's not this conversation of undermining the millennials or Gen whatever, right? And saying, you know, y'all are just on your iPhones all the time, all these stupid apps, doing this, doing that. I don't know what this thing is. What is Instagram? Wasting your life. You're never gonna buy a house because you buy too much avocado toast. Like, you know, we continue to cut them down. And so I see my role as sort of an intermediary, offering them the truth that they are valuable and necessary and needed. And if I can be just a building block for them to stand on, I will have done my work as an artist, as an activist, as a mother, right? As a caregiver.
So we're looking at poverty. We're looking at poverty as it was defined 50 years ago. And we're looking at poverty today. Is it different, Claudia?
I mean, I think it's different because we have more. And in a country where we have more in abundance, there's less access for the most. And I think just globally, when we look at, I mean, I like naming things, right? And I think it's important. When we talk about economic injustice and poverty, there's something that creates it, and that's the accumulation of wealth that's called capitalism. And I think that when we talk about that system of capitalism and we talk about the accumulation of wealth, we're talking about, again, a small percentage of the population that benefits from the poverty of the most. Poverty is a lucrative business. It's become a lucrative. And I think, well, it hasn't become, it always has been. And that's why it's increased, even though there's abundance in the world and enough for everyone. So there are differences in that way. But there's more, there's an abundance, and there's less access to most people. Now, I think the difference is the way in which it's masked. Right, the way in which people feel things. And I don't mean like the way in which you experience poverty. I live in the South Bronx. I was born and raised in the South Bronx. I know how poverty looks. I know what it is to eat a piece of toast with sugar and water. Like, I know that experience. I'm not talking about feeling it that way. I'm talking about our notion of what we think poverty is. If you have the ability to consume we think that we are important because we have the ability to consume. Now, that doesn't mean that we aren't important. Like, being moved in the middle class, even though you live paycheck to paycheck, gives you some sort of illusion of security. You have a job, you could pay a mortgage, you could pay for your car, but what happens if you lose one check or two? Right? So I think that our concept of what poverty is always aligned with the person who's homeless in the street. And we don't even think that the concept and the experience of homelessness has changed, where you have people who are really packed into a house or an apartment, where you have students that graduate and can't afford to go on their own, and they have to go back as adults to live in their mom's and pop's house. That's homelessness. And so I think that the concept, our understanding of homelessness, has been shaped by an illusion that has been created by a system that we must name as capitalism.
So there's a new campaign, this continuation of the work from 1968, is resonating all over this country. And it's based on a revolution of values. Colleen, why is that important now?
So this phrase, revolution of values, is one that King used a lot in this period in describing, I think, what's necessary in order for there to be a revolutionary movement. That it's not something that happens automatically or mechanically, but that we're transformed by the possibility, by beginning to be able to imagine something different. And one of the things that he talked about as one of the real challenges before us, and particularly in building a poor people's campaign and a movement for civil rights, is the ways that we're just really taught over and over and again, both that it's not possible and that we are not the ones that can make it possible. That changes happen by someone else, and that the best we can do is to petition change makers, and we can speak truth to power, and whether they do something with that truth is on them. But that actually our only job is to sort of voice our complaints. But really actually what is possible and necessary is for us to become leaders and to develop other leaders and to become the ones that call for a real revolution. That's first one, a revolution in our hearts and our minds. And then because we have that revolution take place in our communities and our networks and what we're building in the states, and then that's what makes possible real change. Not because people suddenly become more benevolent and sort of give us what we're asking for, but because we're putting forward a real alternative and putting forward the vision for that and the assessment and the analysis, not just of what is happening to us, but how it could be different and why things are wrong. And I think that's really part of what the Poor People's Campaign is doing, is really building each other and we're seeking out other leaders and developing ourselves and studying and engaging in art making together and reading sacred texts together, and that is what becomes a revolution of values and makes possible a real revolution in society.
So Mona, why is this resonating now? Why is it that Liz talked about in so many states where people are involved, 30 plus states where people are involved in this campaign, where people are risking their bodies just to make statements about what's happening in this country? Why right now is it so important? And why is it resonating with folks?
I always make the joke that it took two Bushes to get an Obama. And so, I mean, hopefully it'll only take one Trump to get something really great, right? That's the hope, that's the prayer. Please, God. So, right now, I mean, we're in Washington, D.C., I think he's right there. And I think we're at a critical moment when we're coming to understand that we are not and cannot be single-cause people.
We cannot stand for just one thing. And that the trickery is that they tell us that we have to. And the lie of white supremacy or the empire or colonization or whatever you want to call it is to divide. And that when we are divided, we cannot be powerful. And so people always say, we're speaking truth to power. No, we are the power, speaking truth to domination, right? And when we recognize ourselves as the power and recognize that as nothing but dominion and domination, we shift the narrative. We need to re-empower ourselves, reinvigorate the conversation, and shift our awareness just a tiny bit to let people know that they don't need the liberation of capitalism. Right? They need the liberation of their own hearts. The liberation that they can give to themselves. Right? Because it's just a tiny shift in awareness to tell somebody that you are free. You can be free. It's the system. It's not these people. It's the system. Right? And that you are an agent to make this world more beautiful and better together with the rest of your people. And so this is the moment. This is the moment where we're coming to realize that the ecological crisis is the same as the indigenous genocide, is the same as sexism, is the same as Black Lives Matter, because they are all completely intersectional and one relies on the other, right? Womanist theologian Melanie Harris wrote about this beautifully in a text where she said, "You cannot separate ecocide from genocide. It is impossible, right? And to do that is injustice. To do that is injustice." And so coming to this moment, we're arriving here on the shoulders of so many who came before us, witnessing to that, telling us, join together. Nothing is going to happen until we do that, right? Nothing is going to change or shift. It's just going to take a slight discomfort on our parts, right?
Claudia, what is possible? What is possible? Given earlier you talked about that there's abundance, that we are not suffering because there's not enough. So what is possible?
I'm going to reference Hip Hop Magoo.
Exactly.
Biggie Smalls, the sky's the limit. All
right.
I mean, what is possible in a world of abundance? I think that it's the priorities that need to change. It's the understanding that, I get carried away. So, I mean, there is a possibility for access to school for free in this country. I come from New York City. We have the City University of New York, which was at some point free for everyone. I attended CUNY, and I attended Union Theological Seminary, and then I did my master's degree at Columbia University, and I'm $120,000 in debt. Which I will never pay, because I can't. And in principle, it's wrong to pay it. Just in principle, right? So I feel like what is possible? The access to education is possible. The access to healthcare is possible. The access to dignified, quality living is possible. And I think the question is, what makes it impossible for us to be able to live a dignified life? You know, and it's the same systems that, you know, oppression that you were talking about, white supremacy, imperialism, capitalism. You know, I come here and I bring the Bronx, but I also bring Palestine, I bring Puerto Rico. You know, because the same systems that are in this country messing with us domestically and not allowing us to live dignified lives are the same ones that are killing people in Gaza.
Yeah.
The militarized police that in New York State
In New York City alone, there were $20 million that were dedicated to increase policing in our communities. And they can't give that money to public schools. My mom's a teacher, and she's soon to retire. And she's concerned because she won't be able to live off her retirement after 35 years of servicing the New York City Department of Education. And so everything's possible. The sky's the limit because we have an abundance. I mean, this country is the wealthiest country. And we continue to pillage other countries to accumulate more wealth and create more poverty domestically. So we should look into that, but we should also look into the abundance and who is accumulating that abundance.
Thank you. So as we are we're beginning these 40 days, Colleen, we are looking back and looking forward at the same time, Sankofa move. Mm-hmm. The question really is, what are the big lessons in this campaign for this campaign from 50 years ago?
I like thinking about this with others, and I think it's a great question. I think one of the things that I really love about the way that we've been organizing the Poor People's Campaign and National Call for Moral Revival is that we started in many ways for many decades, building off of many decades of organizing. But this is not something that is new. But as we started to sort of call together this moment and call for the 40 days of action, we organized ourselves around a set of fundamental principles. And I think it's really significant that we didn't actually start with demands. And people really were hungry for the demands, and including ourselves. And like, what is it? You know, what are the policies we're going to ask for? What is it specifically we're going to change? And we sort of held on to the fact that we're actually organizing for something that is longer and bigger than any one policy change. And I think that this was something that was really hard in 1968, that they actually started with a really big vision. And that was, at the moment, it was jobs or income for all. That there would be either a guaranteed employment or a guaranteed income. A universal income. And then this was what King was calling people around. But then King was trying to call for this very diverse leadership. And so he was in touch with Chicano activists and Puerto Rican activists and poor whites from Appalachia. And everybody was organizing in their own communities and organizing around platforms. He called together, really importantly, welfare rights. And there was this moment when he was meeting with the welfare rights, the National Welfare Rights Organization, for the first time. And they had been organizing thousands of poor welfare moms for years. And he said, let's do a poor people's campaign. And they were like, what are you talking about? We've been doing a poor people's campaign for like 4 years now. And when we went to Washington, D.C. to talk about changes in the welfare bill, you weren't there. And so, and King said, you know, at first was very taken aback. This was, but then he said, I'm ready to learn. I'm here to learn. I understand that you know things I don't know, and called them forward. And they did. They played a really important leadership role in pulling together the Poor People campaign. But one of the things that I think was challenging is that they didn't have the time to build together in the way that we've done. And so it became, in some ways, just an amalgamation of what everybody was already working on. And it became a 65-page list of policies that we wanted to change. But I think that what we are building and built around here is this set of fundamental principles. And it doesn't mean we don't have demands. It doesn't mean that there aren't really specific policies. But what actually takes us in the long term is this set of fundamental principles and commitment, and that we're building a leadership together and building this power in our states together. And I think that is really going to take us a long way and keep us tied together.
So one of the things we talk about in this campaign is changing the narrative, changing the the immoral narrative that exists now to explain a lot of things, including poverty. Who is poor? Why are they poor? So why is that important? Why is that particular thing important to change the narrative, Mona?
Because it's about the truth, right? It's about telling the truth, regardless of the consequences. Like, we have to be done with respectability politics. We have to be done trying to say the right thing to get the pleasure of this person or that person. One of the reasons I so respect this campaign is because we're not here in D.C. because we want this leader or that leader from this party or that to stand up with us in solidarity to prove that we have some kind of real power. We recognize the power in this room, the power beyond this room from the people watching the live cast, right? We recognize the true power in this country, which is the power that makes it run. It is the people, right? The poor people on whose backs this country is continuing to be built on, right? So for me, it's about that. And specifically, being a Muslim, being the daughter of immigrants, what's going on in Syria right now is not separate from me. What's going on in Gaza right now is not separate from what's going on in Tuscaloosa or in wherever it is, right? It's not, none of it is separate. It's all the same cause, because at the root of it, justice is justice. And justice breeds justice. The Quran says, فَهَلْ جَزَاءُ الْإِحْسَانِ إِلَّا الْإِحْسَانِ, that is not the response or the recompense of beautiful excellence, anything but beautiful excellence, right? That's all there can be when it is what is brought forth. And so dismantling the narratives of other, like Muslims, we are afraid of Muslims in this country. Why? Because largely they are brown and black, right? Muslims in this country have been here since the slave ships arrived on these very beaches. Like Malcolm said, Plymouth Rock, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us, right? Why? Because, right, those slave ships carried the bodies of Muslim women and men. And now suddenly we have a Muslim problem. No, we have an American problem, right? We don't have a Muslim problem. We have a we have a justice problem, right? And so whatever we're calling it, right, the problem of the Mexican border, the problem of trans people and that they want rights, God forbid, right? Like fear of other. It's all fear of other. And it fuels all of these marginalized and fragmented industries. Islamophobia is nothing more than an industry. It's manufactured. It's built on the death, the lives and the death of Muslims, right? And so for me, this is the only work there is. Where else should any Muslims be but right here, right now? This is Muslim work. This is Christian work. This is Buddhist, Hindu, Sikh, agnostic, atheist work, because this is the work of the people.
So we talked about this campaign, and we're running out of time, but there are just a few last things I think I just want to hear folks talk about. You talked about this being a new campaign, a campaign that's done for this moment, and a campaign that's being built in a different way. So I'd love to hear from each of you what that means. What does it mean that we're building a campaign in a different way, that we're organizing in a time that requires a new method of organizing? What does that mean?
May I echo? Let me think about this for a little bit. I appreciate what Colin was talking about in terms of the lessons
right, and the differences. And I think we have a lot of good herencias, heritage, right, radical legacies. And then we have vices that we pick up along the line, right, as organizers, as educators, that come with living in the system in which we live. And we, I think, have limited our ability to think beyond what's politically possible or economically possible in this context. And I think when we talk about the ways in which the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for more revival, is doing, is in the very structure of the campaign, the state structures, being able to bring folks into a steering committee that represent different organizations that at some point thought that their interests were different because they thought of an issue-based way of organizing. Because, you know, when we think about a nonprofit industrial complex, which is real, you have to fight against your own people to get funding. So you fight amongst each other, even though the interest is still the same. Your desire is to advance the struggles of those who are poor and dispossessed because of funding, right? And so when you bring folks that are tired of being tired, right, and are exhausted of gaining reforms that will not move forward, because when the Democrats leave and then the Republicans come, it becomes like a political game, right, during elections, and nobody talks about the poor. So it's about the interest of elections rather than the interest of the people. And you're gathering these folks from different communities and different organizations into the steering committees, into the coordinating committees, and folks are engaging in study together, engaging in struggle together, struggle from their differences, right, and finding also commonalities. I think that is a strong legacy for what will come after the 40 days, what will come after this year as a multi-year campaign. So there's a level of infrastructure that is being developed by the campaign, along with political education, which I think is the heart of any movement, as long as important as culture. So political education and culture go hand in hand, because it doesn't only move the minds, it moves the hearts. It does something to the gut. So I think that those are some of the things that I've picked up in doing the work with the Poor People's Campaign. And I feel like the infrastructure that's going to be left, the political education, the cultural work, are legacies that are radical, that happened before. They're not new, but somewhere along the line we kind of forgot, and things just kind of were sprinkled here and there, and now they're becoming the core and the center of a lot of our work.
So one of the things that I think is really significant about organizing in a new way in the Poor People's Campaign is really challenging some of the narratives that were told about poverty and about who the poor are. One of those is that the number of people who are poor is small, and that it's just sort of a small segment of society, and if they could just be brought into it's a healthy society if they just get job training or better education and be brought into it. Yeah, and then the other thing is that there's something wrong with us, and that we make poor decisions. And then the other thing is that there's actually not enough to go around. And I think that we are organizing in ways that confront all three of those ideas, and it really takes it on, and part of how it takes it on is through the leadership of the poor, and by us saying that we're not small, and sort of looking at the ways that, you know, if you use the federal level for poverty, and if you say let's say that you made $13,000, you're not poor anymore as an individual, or $26,000 as a family of four, you're not, even if you took that, one in seven of us is poor. And then really questioning that those levels, and actually saying no, that many of us, including myself, fall just right above that, and my ability to stay right above that is always in question as well. And a lot of us sort of move in and out of being below the poverty line or above the poverty line. And so when you really start to look at that, we're talking about something more like half of us. And so to have a society where half of us are not sure that next year will look like this year, or that next year will still look like this year, that's a different context. And then to say that then those of us who are poor are the ones who are part of the leadership of the campaign and part of articulating what it is that we need to go forward, how we're going to go forward and what it is that's necessary, that's a very different way of organizing, and it's a very different conception of how we address poverty, that it's not charity, that it's actually transformation. And I think that we're doing that, and I think that it's really significant.
I think we're tired of a poverty line, period. Why should that even exist? Why should that even be a reality in our world? We're tired of band-aids. We're ready for real solutions. We're ready for real healing, real health. We're ready for solutions which disrupt the illness at the roots, right? And to do that is to do the work of the Poor People's Campaign in its intention, which is long term, right? Which is planning for years out into the future. And using the spiritual imagination of our hearts with which we can see that future that is more beautiful. That future that is possible, that future that we all understand exists, right? The future that if you open up any sacred text, it's right there. Whether you call it the kingdom, whether you call it paradise, whatever you call it, right? It's there. And it's possible, right here, right now, right? I think that's what's so amazing about the Poor People's Campaign, is it's not waiting. It's not waiting for something to happen. It's saying we're doing it. We're bringing it. We're being it. Right? We're done with band-aids. We're done with poverty lines.
I think that's a good place to end this conversation. We are done with them. We are done with band-aids. So please help me thank the folks as well. Tonight is the first of many Tuesdays where the truth will be told right here. We ask folks in this audience to keep coming back. We ask people who are watching this by live stream to join this campaign. The truth will set us free.
That's right.
And will make us the force that we are meant to be in this country. So I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. To take us out with the song.
Great. Great. How are you feeling about standing up?
I'm sure you know the song. Everybody's got it.